Welcome back to the Caught Red Podcast. We are your hosts. I'm Jesse Light.
And I'm Megan Light.
We're just two dog lovers talking about true crime, horror movies, and most likely our dogs, too.
You're going to have to excuse Jesse if he makes a weird or gross noise and he doesn't edit it out.
Yeah, you're just not going to hear a lot from me on this episode. I've got...
The crud.
Thank you, Arkansas Pollen. So, yeah.
You can partially blame me because I wanted to do work out front.
I do blame you.
Oh.
Yeah, we put some mulch. Put some mulch in the front flower bed that doesn't have any flowers.
Well, it's going to have some fake flowers out there and some really pretty pots.
And we swapped out the ugly edging.
Yeah, the garden edging.
Garden edging thing that's been there for who knows how long. And we put in some bricks. So that was expensive, but it looks so much better.
I said we didn't have to get it all in one day. And you're like, no, it's fine.
Fuck it.
It looks really nice, though. Thank you.
We can't just get half of it and then wait a while because it would look stupid.
Well, I mean, like, we could have waited to do it all together, but not bought everything on one day.
Oh.
That's what I meant.
You know me.
Then don't bitch.
I ain't bitching. No movies watched.
No?
I don't think so.
Well, we started Fallout.
Oh, yeah. Been watching Fallout.
And you finished...
I like it. Walt Goggins.
You finished your other show.
Finished Shogun. 10 out of 10 recommend that one. Just got to deal with the subtitles, which I was used to it by the end of it. I was like, I couldn't sleep the other night because I had such a sore throat. So I went into the living room and put the final episode of that on. And I had the volume at like 7 or 8.
Mm-hmm.
And was just obviously reading the subtitles, which is fine because it's all Japanese. Really good show. Megan's...
I'll say, I really don't think there's anything.
Yeah, she's
else.
Been struggling with a few 600-page books, oh. So she had to switch to a 200-page book, I guess. Other than that, nothing really.
I don't know. I just been looking at my stash down there, and like none of them just have been jumping out at me. So I was like, I'll have to just pick one up. And I'm glad I did, because I just powered through it today, and...
What she really wants to do is make another run to Barnes & Noble.
Listen, I'm going to be in North Little Rock next week. Don't think I'm not going to be going to Barnes & Noble. It's fine, love. There's space available on my shelves. It's not drugs. Or a dog. Or a cat.
True. Well, Megan's got an episode for us. Like I said, there might not be much input for me, but we'll see. So, have at it.
Okay, maybe I will. My sources are... And it's kind of funny because you have crud. The American Lung Association... Because yours are not quite up to par.
My lungs are fine.
You got junk.
Yeah, but...
That you're hacking up, spitting in a cup, putting it on the bedside table, and then looking at me.
You're gonna make everybody sick. Oh, Falco almost ate a cough drop, but that was, I guess, the most eventful thing for our dogs this week.
Yeah. I got out of the shower, and I heard a noise, and I was just like, oh, he's chewing on a toy. And then it sounded like a piece of plastic from a toy, so I walked around the bed, and there he was with a wrapper on the floor, and his tongue, he just kept sticking it out, and the cough drop was stuck to it, so I was able to get it out of his mouth, but he was struggling, and I could just hear it clicking against his teeth, and I was like, ah!
He was like, bro, this tastes so good.
It's strawberry. He loves the strawberries. He's not very bright anyways. Back to it. So we got the American Lung Association, PBS.
Oh, yeah, you're going to give us some science shit today.
Yeah. New York State Department of Health, UPI Archives. CBS News, Seattle Times, History.com, HistoryLink.org, an essay by Catherine Beck, a couple of Find a Graves, Justice, U.S. Law, our favorite thing to ever look at, and a book that was sent to me by one of our OGs, and it's called American Mother by the OG, Greg Olson.
You got his autograph somewhere, don't you?
I think so, in one of his books.
He was at the True Crime Fest?
Oh, no, that was James Renner.
Oh, okay.
That guy's pretty cool, too. You ready?
I'm ready.
I have, I think, like a sixth sense. Not that I can talk to dead people or anything like that.
Aw.
But I tend to find, like, this kind of case. So this is not a new subject for me.
What, with pronunciations or...
No.
You'll, something different.
You'll pick up on it soon enough, love, and I'm not taking any pointers, so you're safe.
Was it like the wife killing the husband type shit?
You know it.
For their money?
You're really good at this. The villain in today's story took notes from a seriously scary incident that happened back in the 80s in the Windy City. I think most of you are going to be familiar with that case, but Jesse wasn't. I asked him about it last week, I think, or earlier this week. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about that once I get this ball rolling. What makes this story today a bit more sad is that two people will be killed. One is by pure accident, and the other was the intended target. And there could have been more deaths, but thankfully the authorities hit the ground running and took no chances, again, because of what happened years prior. Most of us, when we have an ache or a pain, we take ibuprofen or acetaminophen. Then in about 20 minutes or so, we should, in theory, feel better. But what if you didn't? What if you got worse? What if you ended up dying? On June 5th, 1986, 52-year-old Bruce Nickel came home from work with a splitting headache. He worked as a heavy equipment operator for the Department of Transportation in Seattle. He did what he had always done when he got a headache. He goes to the medicine cabinet and he took 4 Excedrin capsules. He was one of those that if the bottle recommended 2, he was going to take 4. That's just the way he did things. To help ease his mind, Bruce showered, and then he was going to go out on the deck, and he was going to sit and relax and watch the birds. Just taking it easy after a long day's work. Moments later, he would go back inside and collapse. His wife, Stella, found him by the couch. He had called out for her, saying that he was lightheaded. So she rushes to his side, checks on him. She called 911 at 5:02 p.m.
That bitch poisoned him.
Would you let me tell this story? Where they lived in Kent, Washington, the closest first responder was a volunteer fire department. Upon their arrival, Stella quickly told them that one moment he was watching the scenery and then the next he's unconscious. She told them that he came home with this headache and then she showed them the Excedrin bottle. The volunteers noted that Bruce looked like his coloring was off. His skin was red from the neck up, but then the rest of him neck down was just normal white. He had a pulse, but he's gasping for air. He was taken by helicopter to the Harborview Medical Center in Seattle, where he would unfortunately pass away about 3 hours later. An autopsy was conducted shortly after, and the cause of death was found to be natural causes. When Stella released the body to the pathology department for the autopsy, When it was all said and done, the medical examiner noted that emphysema had taken Bruce's life. And Stella was a bit taken back by this. Bruce had just gotten a physical done for work, and there was nothing on it that said that it was present in his body or that he presented any lung issues at all. And emphysema isn't acute. It takes time to develop, and it gradually damages the tissues in the lungs. So emphysema attacks the alveoli, which are small sacs of air. They will rupture and make one big pocket of air, which means there's less surface area in the lung, preventing oxygen from moving through the bloodstream. That blockage won't allow the lungs to fill as effectively, and breathing becomes very difficult. The individual with emphysema then develops COPD, which is chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. And I'm sure everybody has seen the commercials for some sort of medication on that, unless you're not in the US or Switzerland, because we actually show commercials for medications here.
Nonstop, too. Dude. I always hear emphysema.
Or COPD or something like that.
Yeah. But take this medicine and you'll have these side effects.
Right.
Like, possibly. Like,
they're even worse.
It's like 20 other things that could go wrong.
It's terrible. Bruce would be laid to rest on June 9th. Stella Strong had met Bruce Nickel one afternoon at a bar in Kent. Stella had moved to the area from California, and being the new girl in the neighborhood, everybody had talked about her. Stella was one of those girls who played hard to get. Bruce would order a beer and try to make some small talk with her, and Stella would give him like one-worded answers or just ignore him altogether. What Bruce didn't know was that she knew how to play the game. Like, she was not new to hustling boys around. After leaving him at the bar to go home one night, she was out with a friend and they bumped into each other on the street. After an exchange of pleasantries, she said to her friend, "That man is mine and I'm going to marry him." In March of 1974, Stella and Bruce had moved in together. Stella had found herself an attractive man who she didn't find to be an idiot. Bruce had found a beautiful woman that could match him in intellect, attitude, and they could just tolerate each other. They both liked to hit the town and would go have just wild nights out, you know, drinking, dancing, all the things. Stella grew up in an abusive home with a very alcoholic father. And she liked that Bruce had limits and only drank on weekends for the most part. They could have this good time together, and it never went too far. And Bruce always treated her well, never hit her, never hurt her. The two married in 1976. But Stella was never meant to be a kept woman. Married or not, finding a drinking buddy in Bruce or not, she would still cozy up to other men at the bar, especially if she could get a free drink or two. A year into their marriage, Bruce would grow tired of her antics and they separated. But the two just could not stay apart. They were just drawn to each other. Their fire would spark again and they would, you know, get back together. And they would do this on and off. It was just a repeating cycle for this couple. Eventually, it would be Stella that would start to ask Bruce to slow down his drinking. Money was already tight as it was, and she was worried about how drinking was affecting him as a whole.
So he started drinking more than on weekends?
I think so, especially when she started to step out on him.
Oh, yeah.
In 1979, while the two were out one night, Bruce admitted that he needed help. This revelation actually sent him on a downward spiral, and he pretty much lived in a bottle for like 2 weeks straight. He didn't go to work. He would disappear for hours. He'd come home completely schmammered. And that was like his way of getting it all in and then out of his system. Stella found him an inpatient facility, and when he left after the 30 days, he was sober and he would never have another drop of alcohol again. We're shifting gears a little bit now. In the early morning of June 11th, 1986, was no different than any other. 40-year-old Susan, or known by everyone around her, Sue Snow, was getting ready for work. It was about 6:30 a.m. She made sure her daughter was awake so she could get ready for school. While her daughter, Haley, was in the shower, she thought she had heard a noise. Not thinking much about it, she, you know, thought maybe her mom dropped something in her bathroom. The walls were shared. Haley continued to get dressed in a room, but she noticed that the water in her mother's bathroom was still running. These two were like two peas in a pod. Haley knew her mother's routine like the back of her hand. She knew something was off. Haley goes to her mother's room, and she finds her on the floor. Remembering what she had learned in health class, Haley checked to see if her mother was breathing, and she called 911. Dispatch questioned Haley, trying to obtain whatever they could from this 15-year-old girl who's scared to death that something's wrong with her mom. Haley said she must have fallen while she was in the shower. She's breathing, but she looked red, and she's not responding. That call was made at 6:43. First responders arrived at 6:47. Sue was taken by helicopter from Auburn, Washington, to Harborview Medical Center in Seattle. Sometime after 7:30, she was pronounced brain dead and then taken off life support at 11. So very quickly, whatever happened to Sue. Less than 4 hours. Sue Snow's appearance, noted by first responders at her home, and then the condition her body was in while in the hospital, made it a very easy decision for an autopsy to be done. At the home, she was red from the neck up, white down. While admitted in the hospital, she looked swollen all over her body, so much so that her eyes looked like little slits. It was reported that the autopsy took place the day after Sue passed, so more than likely the 12th. Medical examiner Dr. Corrine Fligner and her pathology assistant Janet Miller began with the external examination. But once Dr. Fligner made her initial incision, her assistant made a funny face, like snarled up her nose. The scent of bitter almonds had struck her assistant. She looked at Dr. Fligner and said, "I smell cyanide." Dr. Fligner could not, but that didn't mean she didn't believe her assistant. The ability to detect the smell of cyanide can vary from person to person due to genetic differences in his or her olfactory receptors.
And it just smells like almonds?
Mm-hmm.
Huh. I bet I could smell it.
I don't know. Well, not right now, probably.
No. My left nose, I could smell out of, but not my right.
So this means that there are variations in receptors that can lead to differences in odor perception. Somewhere between 20 and 40% of the population doesn't carry the gene to detect cyanide. And cyanide is no joke. Depending on the amount administered or ingested, you have 5 minutes to seek help or say goodbye. At the most, 5 minutes. The easiest way to describe what it does to the body is that because the cyanide molecules look similar to oxygen, it can take its place. It prevents oxygen from doing its job as part of the energy-making process. More specifically, the mitochondria. Do you remember what I told you about that?
Yeah.
What's it called?
The powerhouse.
Correct.
Boom.
The powerhouse. Mitochondria cannot produce adenosine triphosphate, which is ATP, which is energy.
This might be a dumb question, but is cyanide, would that be in the form of liquid or would it be like in a form of like powder?
Most of the time it's in sort of some sort of powder form.
Okay.
But I'm sure there is a way to manipulate it into gas or liquid.
Gotcha.
That's not a dumb question.
Well.
So when ATP cannot be produced. It affects the most important tissues in the body, like the heart, among other muscles, and then nerve cells. So it uses whatever energy it has left, those tissues, and when they run out, those tissues start to die. For example, the diaphragm slows down, leaving a person gasping for air. The heart will struggle to beat until the person goes into cardiac arrest.
There probably wasn't any, but were there any pictures of her, like, swollen up?
No. I don't think so.
That'd have been interesting.
I can visualize it.
Uh-huh. I wonder if you could Google someone that has died of cyanide poisoning.
I'm sure.
And it'd be like that.
I'm sure it's in some sort of toxicology book or something.
I'll look it up.
You should. Keeping what her assistant has just said in mind, Dr. Fligner made a note for the toxicology screening to check for cyanide. 4 days later, when the results came in, it concluded that Sue Snow had indeed died from acute cyanide poisoning. Sue Chapman, or Snow as we're going to know her, was the manager of a bank branch in Auburn, Washington. She had first started back as a teller in 1969 and just worked her way up the ranks. She would get her GED while she's employed at the bank. She had gotten pregnant with her first daughter, Exa. And I don't know if that's short for anything, but it's just E-X-A, Exa, when she was 16. So she missed out on all the fun stuff that teenagers were supposed to experience. So at this job, she did let her looks and her personality help her move up. And she had no shame. She was smart. She was a great employee. She would go on to marry Connie Snow, and he loved Exa as his own daughter. They would end up having Haley together, which was the 15-year-old that called 911 for her mom. Sue was hard on her girls because she didn't want them to end up like her. She wanted the best for them. Her strictness would cause a lot of tension in the household, and her and her oldest daughter, Exa, bumped heads a lot. The thing was, though, as good as a man that Connie, her husband, was, he was just kind of blah, kind of boring. Sue was outgoing, and he was a homebody. Sue had told her twin sister Sarah that she cheated on Connie several times. Towards the end of their marriage, Sue packed up herself and the girls, and they would move to New Mexico from Washington to help take care of her sick father. And Connie would send money in hopes of her coming back to him, but there really was no point. And they would be separated for many, many years before they even got divorced. In 1978, Exa would introduce her mother to Paul Webking, who was a long-haul truck driver with three ex-wives. I think they were living in the same apartment complex at the time. The two would date on and off, and then on a whim, on Thanksgiving Day in 1985, Sue and Paul get married. And it's funny that Exa introduced the two of them because she never really even liked Paul that much.
So, like, nearly every image you gotta click on and say view image because it's that disturbing.
Really?
Yeah. So, I guess there's, like, you can die of cyanide smoke inhalation, and that really fucks up your organs. Oh, my God. But, yeah, this face.
Let me see. Oh, wow, look at those patches. Ugh.
So I don't know if that's from being in the flames of, like, a cyanide fire. I'll have to look more into that.
Well, keep doing some research
hydrogen
over there.
Hydrogen cyanide poisoning.
Well, this is potassium cyanide that is being used.
Gotcha. That would make a difference.
Exa wasn't alone. Sue's twin sister, Sarah, wondered how her sister could have fallen for a guy like Paul, but, you know, she supported her sister, so she kept her mouth shut, and she just would keep an eye on Paul, the manipulator, as she called him. Sue even knew that her husband had cheated on her, and she wasn't shy about making it a public thing. It was like this obsession for her. She constantly worried that he was going to step out on her. So this obsession plus her job led to Sue having these chronic headaches. And she would take extra strength Excedrin, too, each morning as part of her routine along with her vitamins. Her headaches were no secret. Sue would buy bottles and then she would immediately take the caps off so she could just have easy access. So they would sit on the shelf. She could just reach her fingers in, grab what she needed, and then take her medicine and go about her day. Dr. Fligner, when she contacted the police, let them know that it was possible that Sue had been poisoned by tainted Excedrin capsule. Of course, suspicion falls on Paul. It was him and Haley and Sue living in the house at the time. Paul had told the detective on the case that Sue would have taken 2 in the morning because that's her routine. He himself had taken 2 before he left for work. And he knew that they had been low on their stock of Excedrin. So he told Sue to add it to their grocery list and she must have gone and picked some more up. When Paul took his on the morning of the 11th, the bottle, cap already off, was nearly full. Paul did consent to a search of the house. Auburn detectives go through the home, collecting any prescription and non-prescription bottles, vitamins, antacids, which Tums are a big thing here at our house. I think we need more, by the way. If it was in a cabinet or in some sort of medical supplement bottle of whatever kind, it was taken into evidence. They would also go through the trash piece by piece. One thing that detectives noticed while gathering everything in that house, if it was some sort of medicine, it was a tablet. Except that new bottle of Excedrin, those were capsules. Sue's sister Sarah said, say that 5 times fast, said that they both bought medication in tablet form, especially after everything that happened in Chicago. Her oldest daughter, Exa, would also tell the police that her mother never bought capsules. By the evening of June 16th, so 5 days after Sue had passed, 4 days since they determined the cyanide poisoning, the FDA had completed chemical analysis of the Excedrin capsules taken from Sue's house. They found that there were about 10 tainted capsules, tainted with potassium cyanide. There were 56 remaining in the bottle that started with the bottle of 60. So 2 Paul took, 2 Sue took. He was fine, she was not, but then there was 10 more tainted ones. If Sue bought this bottle from her normal store, Albertsons, were there more tainted bottles out there? But what are the odds that Paul safely takes his 2? So surely it was probably something he did. But he's cooperating. He takes a lie detector test. He passes. They will eventually eliminate him as a suspect. To be on the safe side, Auburn police begin flooding stores in the area. They are taking all Excedrin from the shelves. And of course, following the test results, the FDA had informed the FBI of the case in Auburn, Washington. The Auburn police were unaware at the time that the FBI would take over jurisdiction because it was a consumer product that was tampered with. This was a law passed after the Chicago Tylenol murders. For those out there, like Jesse, and that's fine. This is like education on top of everything else. If you have not heard of the Chicago Tylenol murders, here is your Reader's Digest version. In September and October of 1982, just 4 years before what I'm talking about, 7 Chicago residents died from potassium cyanide. These victims consumed Tylenol brand capsules, acetaminophen capsules. One girl, 12 years old, Mary Killerman, was hospitalized after taking just 1. She passed away the next day. The same day she died, six family members, the Janises, would all die from taking Tylenol from the same bottle. There was an investigation into the Janises' deaths. The Tylenol bottle was found to be dated with like the same day purchase as them being taken. There were exactly six missing. The notorious smell of bitter almonds was discovered by the medical examiner. Testing was done on the bodies and the capsules that potassium cyanide was found, and it was only found in 4 out of 44 remaining capsules in the Janices' bottle, but those 4 had 3 times the fatal amount of cyanide. So it was just horrible luck that each family member took one Tylenol and all died.
Horrible luck, or somebody was out to get them?
Don't know.
Well, I mean, like, was it the, like, the, Dr. Death kind of thing, where somebody at the pharmacy's purposely corrupting these capsules?
So, okay, I'll get to that in just a second.
Okay.
Keep your thought. The bottles taken from the Kellerman and the Janus homes had come from the same lot number, and a recall was made for that specific lot number. When multiple agencies went searching through the stores in the Chicago metro area, there were tainted bottles throughout the whole city.
Yeah, it's like, surely it's not just a fuck-up, because right. That's kind of a big deal.
Yes.
You can't just accidentally put cyanide poison in something like that.
Right. So during their investigation, cyanide was not put in the bottles at the plant, but by someone entering the stores and physically adding cyanide to the capsules. There was one suspect, James Lewis, but this is technically an unsolved case because they could never prove it was him, and he died last year in 2023.
Was I right about the Dr. Death, or am I thinking of the wrong doctor?
You might that be thinking of a different... That show we watched
with the dude from...
The nurse.
The nurse.
The nurse. Not the good nurse. What is
the
that
The good
called?
Nurse.
Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
With the guy from Fantastic Beasts.
Yeah, he's messing with the IV drips.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, you're kind of along the same lines. So this James guy he was just a disgruntled either employee or customer, and he'd written a lot of threatening letters. That's why they assumed it was him, but they've never been able to solve who did this.
They ain't got videotape that they can go back on?
Not 1982.
Oh, yeah.
If they did, it'd be fuzzy as hell.
Still, that's got to take a lot of time and effort to go through all those capsules.
Mm-hmm.
And it would have to be at the site, right? I mean,
yeah, unless
couldn't just take them home with him and bring them back. But
well,
I guess he could.
You could, because after this incident, that's why all the over-the-counter medications have a safety seal. It happened after this.
Oh, really?
So he could have taken boxes home and messed with them and then took them back and put them on miscellaneous shelves in different stores.
Interesting. Yeah, I've never thought about
why we
capsules and tablets, like the difference. But yeah, now I can see, like, I'm never taking a capsule again.
Right. We have tablets here at the house.
Yeah, fuck that.
Similar to what happened in Chicago, the FDA issued an alert that the death of Sue Snow was caused by cyanide poisoning. Investigators from areas went into grocery stores, and they were going to pick up all the extra strength Excedrin bottles, specifically the lot number 5H102. Excedrin's manufacturer, Bristol-Myers, made a statement that it was doing a nationwide recall, even though the only evidence of tainted capsules was found in one bottle in Auburn, Washington. After Bristol-Myers made the announcement of the recall, a King County officer was on break when dispatch informed him of this hysterical woman who had called the police because her husband had taken Excedrin right before he died, and she had a bottle with the lot number 5H 102, the same lot number of the bottle from Sue Snow's home. When the officer arrived at the Nickel residence, Stella went on and on about Bruce and his death. The officer told her that he would contact Harborview Medical Center and get whatever information was in her husband's file. When the officer asked Stella what the ruling was as the manner of death, she told him it had been natural causes brought on by emphysema. She went to the kitchen and she returned with the bottle of Excedrin with 8 capsules remaining. She also gave the officer a second bottle with a loose cap on it, but it was still full. She let the officer know that her husband had been complaining of bad headaches the last week that he was alive and would take 3 or 4 capsules a day. Stella remembered that she bought the first bottle in Auburn and the second in Kent. The officer went back to his station. He tells his supervisor everything that he found out from Stella. He brought with him the 2 bottles, and they were taken into evidence. Harborview Medical was no help to the officer. To them, it was case closed. Bruce Nickel was dead. He was buried. But Dr. Fligner was a different story. She knew that there was a sample of Bruce's blood in storage. She was going to send it off for testing. The 2 bottles that Stella handed over were also tested. Capsules in both bottles would come back positive for cyanide. And then Bruce's blood was tested to also have been found with cyanide in it. So technically, Bruce Nickel was the actual first victim, dying about a week before Sue Snow. The FBI and the FDA would go to Stella's residence and they go to interview her and go over everything in her home. Stella thought that she had bought 1 bottle 2 weeks before and then the second one, which was unopened a few days before Bruce died. So she bought them both before Bruce had passed away. She did think that that first bottle was bought at Albertsons in Auburn, which was the same store that Sue Snow shopped in there in Auburn. She herself had taken capsules from the same bottle, and it was actually on the day that Bruce had his funeral. Stella had come home, and she took 2 Excedrins to ease the tension in her back. Stella told a fluffed version of hers and Bruce's lives together. She was so proud of him. He had just become a permanent employee of the state's Department of Transportation when he passed that physical. That's why she had such a hard time accepting that Bruce died from emphysema. The agent from the FBI that was speaking with her used to work for the state, and he knew that all employees could opt in or out of life insurance policies. And as far as Stella knew, there was only 1 policy, and it was fairly basic, maybe $5,000. With the help from everyone and all these different agencies involved, 5 bottles of Excedrin were sent off for testing. Bottle 1 came from the Snow House. Bottle 2 was taken from a Johnny's store in Kent, Washington. Bottles 3 and 4 came from Stella. Bottle 5 was from a Pagan Save store, but it wasn't Excedrin. It was the generic brand Anacin 3. The bottles of capsules with cyanide varied in each bottle. 4 in one, 6 in the other, you know, just nothing consistent. But the thing that did link them all together was kind of odd. There were these little green specks inside all of the tainted capsules. Future analysis of those green specks would conclude that they were made of monuron, simazine, and atrazine. These 3 components are algicide. They kill algae, like in a fish tank. The FBI would soon discover there's 1 specific product out there called Algae Destroyer, and it treats tropical fish aquariums. When the reported finding went out from the chemical lab there in D.C. to the Seattle office, one of the agents there said, "You know, I remember seeing a couple of fish tanks at the Nickel House." Since Paul Webking, Sue's husband, had been ruled out, all the authorities could think was that this is something random like Chicago. But now, they're looking closer at Stella. The biggest question on everyone's mind was, if she had gotten away with killing her husband, why did she come back out and bring it back up? Bruce's death certificate had stated natural causes. And it was long before Sue Snow ever died.
So, for these algicides, the specks that were in the capsules, is that something that could have killed too, or?
Not in the amount found.
Why were they in there?
I'll get to that. Yes. Patience, my love. Going over their notes, things started to look different under this new discovery. For example, when Stella was so certain where she bought the capsules, at first was like, wow, she's got a great memory. But now it's like, oh, was she saying Albertson specifically because she knew the tainted supply was there? Looking further into Bruce's life insurance policy gave them an answer. If Bruce died from natural causes, Stella would be awarded $5,000. But if his death was accidental, she would get $135,000. The FBI speculated that Stella called 911 for two reasons. First, she knew that there were other bottles out there and more people could die. Two, she knew she'd get more money.
When she called the police, what did she say about her husband? Like
the first time when he was passed out or the second time after Sue Snow's death?
Whenever she was just calling that he was dying?
So the first call on the 5th when Bruce passed away, she just said that she was frantic. You know, my husband, he's not breathing. He needs help. But when they get there, she's also like remotely kind of calm in her like bathrobe and just like drinking a pop.
Yeah, but if it has to be accidental, you know, instead of natural causes, like a heart attack would be natural causes.
Right.
So she'd have to explain that it was some sort of an accident if she wanted that $130,000, right, instead of $5,000.
Right. Hold your thought.
Okay.
I will answer that. You're getting good, love. I like it. I'm pretty sure I explained that. Hold on. Yes, okay. Yeah, I will explain that in just a minute. We just got to get there. The FBI sent one of their own into town to visit different little pet supply stores to see which one would carry that algicide brand. This special agent, his name is Jack Cusack, and I was like, hell yeah, Cusack.
John's brother?
Oh, that'd be so cool. He would end up speaking with Tom Noonan, who was a store manager of Fish Gallery and Pets. Funny enough, he'd actually known Sue Snow when she helped him get a car loan like years prior.
Can you purchase cyanide from a place like that?
I don't think so. Mm-hmm. That'd be weird.
Well, you never know.
That's true. But when the agent got there, he wasn't asking about Sue. He had no idea that the manager even knew her personally. The manager was shown some photographs, and on one of them, he taps on this woman wearing glasses and said that she had been in and out of that store, but he just couldn't think of her name. But that was enough, because Tom had pointed out Stella Nickel. Stella was a frequent customer to that store, coming in almost every week. It made me think about how many times we go to PetSmart and see Jerry or Mr. Mike.
Jerry. And his Ford fucking Ranger.
Dude, and his cigar out and his Ford fucking Ranger. He's so cool. Tom thought maybe Stella was lonely because she came in so often. And she used to just walk around and just look at all the beautiful fish in the store. When the agent asked Tom about Algae Destroyer, something about his facial expression spoke louder than words. Tom said that he didn't typically carry it because he'd rather have liquids in stock. Stella didn't like the liquid algae killer. She had said to him, "Well, I guess I'll just go and buy it at some other store," and Tom didn't want to lose a loyal customer like her, so he special ordered in that Algae Destroyer for Stella. Now, other customers would buy it when it was in stock on the shelves, but he brought it in mainly to keep her. Tom also made sure to tell her, and of course the other customers, how important it was for those green algae tablets to be crushed before adding hot water. Now things are making more sense to the agent. That little hamster in his wheel up there in his brain is just, you know, running real fast. The green particles, those specks that were found in the tainted capsules, were there by accident. The person who tainted with those capsules must not have rinsed out that bowl well enough or at all after crushing up those algae tablets and then used that same bowl to put the cyanide in to put it into the capsules.
Or whatever tool she was using to crush them up on the table, she used the same tool to crush up.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
Huh.
But this is just a theory. They're going to need some solid evidence.
That makes sense.
About a month later, September 1986, Equifax is steadily working on Stella's now new claim. All insurance companies investigate accidental deaths. So they were working on this new claim now that Stella has provided them with a new death certificate. Stella would call and check on the process. She played that sad widow card. "I miss my husband. Oh my God, I can't believe he's gone." She even offered to help speed this whole process up by bringing the original death certificate instead of just a copy. Or she had numerous articles that she'd cut out of the newspaper that were written about Bruce's death. Not his old death from emphysema. That probably would have just been one obituary. But now he's headline news. You know, he's been poisoned. And the insurance advisor thought, you know, this woman can't be a killer. She just needs money to get life moving along. Despite the findings and whatever conclusion that Equifax would come to, Stella would not be rewarded anything because she was a suspect in an ongoing case, a federal case. She was the FBI suspect. And the FBI, they needed help to get her. And there was one person that they've been trying to talk to for months, and that's Stella's own daughter, Cindy. And Cynthia Lee, she was born October 1959 when Stella was like 15 or 16. So something her and Sue had in common was teenage pregnancy. Stella had been seeing this really nice farm boy, Ricky. He was 17 and she was 13 at the time. Even at that young age, Stella looked and acted older than she was. But when she came up pregnant, she never really said who the father was. She came up with a couple of different excuses. She said that along with seeing this Ricky boy, she was seeing this other boy named Russell, and he was in a different town. And when she visited him once, he and a buddy of his gang raped her, which seems like the worst kind of excuse to being, you know, instead of just saying your boyfriend and you had sex, you come up with gang rape.
Right.
But she got the idea because her sister went through a similar incident. But again, it's like, how do you have two kids that have the same thing happen? That's very odd.
Mm-hmm.
But people went along with it, and she refused to marry the Russell guy because she didn't want her baby to be seen as like this bastard child result of rape. So she goes running back to Ricky, who actually did care for her. And he was happy to tell everybody that the baby was his. Around Christmas of that same year, Stella's mother, Cora, asked her and the baby to come live with them. And she'd watch the baby, and Stella could go back to school and get her GED. She could go to a trade school. I mean, do anything she wanted to do to better her life for her and now her one-year-old baby. But Stella took advantage of her mom. And while her mom is at home babysitting, Stella is just running off with all these men. And she liked older men. She would become pregnant for the second time in 1962. But her mom convinced her to put this baby boy up for adoption. She does. She gives birth to a third child, a daughter, Leah Ruth, in 1966. Stella was actually married at the time, but she cheated so often on her husband, so who knows if that was even his. When Bruce passed away, Cindy wasn't living with Stella. She's, you know, in her 20s by this point, so she's living with a family friend. Cindy had always been loyal to her mom for some reason. They had a weird bond, even though her mom neglected her a lot growing up or would beat her sometimes. Stella would get Cindy a job with her at SeaTac Airport doing like TSA jobs. And so they were together a lot of the time. And then something in Cindy just snapped one night in October of 86. She had a lot of things built up inside of her. She knew a lot of secrets because her and her mom shared, a very weird bond. She gets really drunk one night with the family friend she's living with, who is more of a mother to her than her actual mom. And Dee, the friend, simply just asked her, you know, what is wrong? What is going on with you? Dee could tell that something was eating away at this poor girl and had been for a really long time. Dee and Cindy were fighting more and more, and she was just over it. So Cindy says to Dee, she says, do you want to know why I'm so bitchy? Because my mom killed my dad. When Stella had married Bruce, her two girls loved him. Loved him, looked up to him. That was stepdad, but more of a dad, the only dad they ever really had. He cared for them as their own. So she called Bruce dad, not stepdad, not Bruce. Everything just came out like an unstoppable word vomit. Cindy talked about all the different affairs her mom had while married to Bruce. She talked about wanting to buy drugs and use them in Bruce's iced tea. She talked about how her mom said it would be easy to reenact those Chicago murders. Cindy told Dee that there was this white, powdery-looking substance in a Tupperware container in their shared locker at the airport, and Cindy was pretty certain it was cyanide. And she had seen it just before Bruce died.
Boom, gotcha, bitch.
Cindy knew... she knew her mother had researched poisons. But Cindy was nervous to come forward and talk to the FBI. So Dee did it. Dee reached out to that Seattle field office up there.
How you research poisons in 1986? You go to the library and look up books.
And that'll be something else. So keep that in mind, too. Ooh, love! You should be sick more often. Dee was the one that talked to the FBI and said that Stella killed Bruce... and then told the agents about hers and Cindy's conversation, but Cindy wasn't ready to come forward. Cindy was kind of torn because she wants to tell the truth. She wants to come out about what happened to Bruce, but again, her and her mom have this weird bond, and her mom is telling her about all these great things that they can do and have when Bruce's money comes in. In December of 1986... Stella, after coming up with excuse after excuse after excuse, finally agreed to be polygraphed. Now, the special agent who's been on this case from the very beginning, the same one that went to the store, Mr. Cusack, Jack Cusack, decided that he wanted to kind of rile her up beforehand. He sits down next to her in the interrogation room. She's not hooked up to any equipment yet. He said, "Why don't you just tell us in your own words why you killed Sue Snow and Bruce? I know you did it. You know you did it." Then this other agent comes walking in and he's got the box and he sets it on the table and it's all this evidence they have pointing to her. And that's when Stella's like, "Attorney, I want my attorney." With the advice of her lawyer, she does take multiple polygraphs. The first two were inconclusive. The last one, she failed. Afterwards, of course, they let her go. Stella goes running to her friend's house to vent. She said, "They told me I lied, that I lied about taking capsules from that same bottle that Bruce did. They asked me about it with those tests, and I said, no, I never took them." And her friend is looking at her kind of funny, and she's like, "But you told me, too, that you took capsules because your back was hurting after the funeral." And it was just something about Stella and her friend chatting that her friend was just like, something's not adding up here. So she contacts the FBI. When she's telling the FBI about this recent conversation with Stella, she tells them that Stella had been enrolled in taking these financial management and investment courses at a community college because Stella said that she's going to come into some insurance money and she needed to know how to properly handle it. And speaking of the insurance, the FBI has this really old school veteran, 10 plus years doing this job, and all he does pretty much is go over forgeries and paperwork and stuff like that. So he's going through the life insurance application that was submitted. He notices that Bruce's name does not match Bruce's name. So he had not signed any of this life insurance paperwork. When he compares Stella's signature to Bruce's, the nickels are identical. She didn't even try to make the nickel after Bruce's name look different than hers. And this paperwork was dated a year before Bruce even died.
So instead of going to financial management school, she should have went to forgery school?
Yes, absolutely. She'd been planning this for a hot minute, it seems like. Clearly.
But how can you mess up your story and say that you didn't take the pills after you said you took the pills?
She told so many lies, I'm sure, that everything was... With. Yeah.
Lies on top of lies.
Mm-hmm. FBI was stuck, though. They had circumstantial evidence. Everything that they had accumulated in the Nichols case wasn't going to be enough to indict Stella under the new federal law passed, because this is going to be the first product tampering case. They needed rock solid evidence.
So her daughter coming in and as a witness wasn't going to be enough?
They do need her. And she does finally come in and speak with the FBI. And she tells everything. Cindy said Stella was growing bored of Bruce now that he was sober, even though she's the reason he even got help. She pushed him to go to rehab. She said that Stella killed him because if they divorced, she'd have to give away half of her things. And she wanted money to open her own fish store. Stella had been seeing one of Bruce's good friends for over a year. This so-called good friend, Jim McCarthy, had a dark room in the house, and cyanide is used in photography. Stella had gone to several different libraries to research poisons and had discovered this little unknown fact. But before using cyanide, Stella had filled capsules with a poisonous seed and gave it to Bruce, but it only made him lethargic. This is backed up by Stella's friend, the one she ran to talk to after her polygraph. The friend had said that a couple months prior, she remembers sitting at the house with Bruce there on the couch. And when she walked in, she said that he's just kind of zoned out, looking off in a distance. Didn't even notice that she was there or next to him on the sofa. And she thought that was kind of strange. But now it kind of makes sense that if he was drugged by something.
How did that come about? Like, did she finally admit that she did it? That she drugged him with that other stuff? Or, like, who told that story?
Again, I will get to that. I know, it's fine. No, you're doing it. No, it's fine. I'll get to that. Over the past couple years, Cindy told of plans that Stella plotted but never went through with. For example, hiring a hitman, tampering with his tractor trailer, putting drugs in his iced tea. One day, Stella had just blurted out something about copying the Tylenol murders. Cindy gave them plenty to work with, but the FBI was afraid it wasn't going to hold up in court, especially because now Bristol-Myers and whatever other drug manufacturer with them was giving a $300,000 reward for someone to come forward with information. So now everybody's going to look at it and say, oh, she's coming forward for the money.
Stella should have done something with the tractor trailer. That's what she should have done.
Well, yeah. Yeah.
Just cut a few hoses and
the brake lines.
Yeah.
The FBI started to follow up on what they could from Cindy's interview. They spoke with Jim McCarthy, who acknowledged being with Stella at her house without Bruce multiple times, even the day before Bruce died, but he didn't own up to any affair. An agent was sent to the libraries and, with a subpoena and the librarian's help, pulled all the books Stella could have checked out. He looked through the covers until he would find her name stamped in them. The book was called Deadly Harvest, and there was one other overdue book under her account called Human Poisoning from Native and Cultivated Plants.
So she still had this book?
She did. It's somewhere at the house, I guess.
It's like you at Redbox renting Boogeyman and...
We still have it.
Still have it.
6 years later, 7 years later. Yeah. Her prints were on the pages about cyanide, hemlock, and other toxic seeds.
She just have like highlights throughout the books.
Her prints were also found on three different encyclopedias at another library.
Just little note cards on certain pages.
Besides having dog ears on a couple of the cyanide pages, there were one of the encyclopedias had half a page missing, like she probably tore it out and took it with her.
Yeah, because you can't screenshot those
in
1986.
No. The FBI had learned that money was tight at the Nichols house. They were close to losing their home.
So she couldn't have hired a hitman.
No. She poor.
I guess she could have. She could have just said, I'll pay you later.
Right.
Yeah. No money up front.
She showed me her boobies and I liked him too. They were several months behind on payments. Interestingly enough.
What did they do for a living?
He worked for the Department of Transportation for the state, and she worked at an airport, kind of doing...
Oh, yeah, TSA.
Yeah, that kind of stuff.
Well, why are they behind on money? Who knows? Buying all the poison, expensive.
All right.
All her aquariums stuff, I'm sure, was expensive. Yes. Yeah. She had like 1,000 fish in her house.
In April, there was a letter that Stella had written to the mortgage company. She put a check in there with it. In the letter, she stated she had marital problems, but they're going to be solved, and Bruce was no longer involved. 4 days before Bruce's death, she sent another letter with a check that said all payments will be current now. that the same forms that the FBI veteran guy was looking over for the applications for life insurance policies, they found two fingerprints, both Stella's, which they already figured because she forged his signature anyways. After months of witnesses appearing and testifying before a grand jury, finally on December 9th, 1987, Stella Nickel was indicted by a federal grand jury on 5 counts of product tampering, 2 that resulted in the deaths of Sue Snow and Bruce Nickel. She'd be arrested that same day. Trial would begin April 1988, and after a month long, witnesses in and out, it came down to the prosecutor's closing statement.
Wait, so how was she connected to the Snow deaths?
Momentarily, you will learn.
Okay.
Momentarily. Prosecutor Joanne Maida said Stella made 3 major mistakes. The first was that algae destroyer tablet contamination. Second was not letting Bruce's first death certificate stand. Third, she had 2 out of the 5 tampered bottles because what are the odds? She does a recap of the crucial evidence. Things that caught Stella in a lie. For example, the Anison 3 that was found at the Pay and Save store, Stella said she never shopped there, but there were checks written by Stella for items bought at that store. The particular capsule count in that Anison 3 bottle wasn't stocked at that store. It was at Johnny's in Kent, where Stella was a frequent customer and where one of the other bottles was found.
Going back to the paying checks, that's why you always pay in cash.
Cash is king. Near the end of day, May 9th, 1988, the jury found Stella guilty on all counts of product tampering. She was sentenced to 2 90-year terms to be served concurrently. She was denied parole in 2017. She petitioned for compassionate release in 2022 because she had bad health. They denied her. She has another chance at parole in 2024. What is crazy is that despite her old age, like right now she's 80, there is no statute of limitations for murder. And it's doubtful it happens, but she could still be charged with the murders of Sue Snow and Bruce Nickel. She just wasn't at the time. She was never given parole because Haley, Sue's daughter, appeared every time and demanded this woman not be released. And Stella maintains her innocence. She blamed Cindy for coming up with all these lies so she could get that reward money. And Cindy would get $250,000 out of that $300,000 from the drug companies. What sucks is that Sue Snow's daughters and her family, they did nothing wrong. They didn't even know Stella. Sue had just picked up the wrong bottle at the wrong time at the same store she shopped at every week. The same store that Stella would also go shopping at. So Sue died by pure accident. But if it hadn't been her, it would have been somebody else that bought that same bottle of Excedrin. And it's odd because Sue never bought capsules, just tablets. So again, it was just happenstance that she grabbed the wrong bottle of Excedrin.
So let me get this straight, because I'm confused.
Okay.
So Stella didn't buy the bottles, take them home, and put the cyanide in them for her, just for her husband?
So in order to make it all work, for Bruce to be found with an accidental death, she put multiple bottles with tainted capsules across the city, hoping for a similar incident like in Chicago. That was never solved. She didn't think she
bought the bottles, manipulated them, and then put them back on the shelves?
Yes. Because everywhere? If multiple people were sick or died, like in Chicago, it'd be ruled an accident.
And they're behind-the-counter drugs?
Over-the-counter drugs. Like when we walk into Kroger and I grab like ibuprofen or Advil, they're just right there.
Okay.
So she walked in, grabbed them, took them home, manipulated them, like you said, and then put them back on the shelves. So if multiple people were coming down, it would look just like Chicago.
Uh-huh.
And one person had not been caught or blamed for that. She thought she could get away scot-free. Bruce would be found accidentally killed because she assumed that first autopsy, they would find the cyanide. They didn't, because the medical examiner that did Bruce's autopsy couldn't smell the almond smell and had no reason to test him for cyanide poisoning. Does that help you?
Yes.
Yep.
Yes.
So she was hoping that she could replicate what happened in Chicago.
Where was this at? Washington?
Washington State. Auburn, Washington.
Wild.
Yep. And that is that's the story of Stella Nickel and her way of getting some insurance money. So I brought the book up here because I was going to read off to you. Because I said...
You got them dog ears.
No, I got to post it. I had said that after 1982, everything that happened, there's those seals, right? So those bottles that Stella took would have had the safety seals. Now, bottle one came from Sue Snow. It had no wrapping, no box, no cap, because Sue would just take them off, stick them in the cabinet, and have easy access when she'd have a headache. So they couldn't prove any tampering on that one because she'd already done it herself and thrown it in the trash. Bottle two, that was at Johnny's in Kent, which is another store that Stella frequented. The safety seal around the neck of the bottle had been cut, like a small sliver, enough that she could just probably get her fingers in there, pull some out, put them back in, none the wiser. Bottle three was from the Nickel home, and it doesn't matter because the safety seal was gone. Bottle four, again, no safety seal. It was at Stella's house. And then bottle five was that one at the Pay and Save, which was the wrong capsule count for that store to even carry, so it had to have come from somewhere else. The FBI determined that even though the bottle was in the box, it had been re-glued shut, and they also determined that the safety seal had been partially removed and then kind of heated shut again.
Huh.
So she went through quite the process. Trial and error.
So she was willing to just kill a bunch of other people just to have her husband killed by accident.
More or less, yes.
And you said how many bottles were found with the cyanide?
Five.
Five. But there could have been more.
There could have been more, but she...
Was there like a national news report that said, hey, don't yes. take these pills yep. because there could be cyanide poisoning in yep. one of them if you bought it?
There was a specific lot number that two of the bottles they found immediately. Three bottles. Sue Snow, the two from Stella's house that they identified right away. So anybody with that lot number... Toss them, just in case.
Yeah.
And then I'm sure everybody that bought Excedrin back in 86 was like, these are capsules. I'm not doing it. And threw it away.
Crazy. Crazy. Psycho bitch.
Yep. Just for a little bit of quiche. A lot of bit of quiche, really.
A lot of quiche.
I wonder, 135,000 back in the 80s is what nowadays?
A lot. She could have definitely started up a fish store.
Mm-hmm.
Well, good job, love.
Thank you.
That's it for today's episode. We'll be back next week with yet another episode of the Caught Red podcast. But until then, stay local, shop local,
murder local.